Well, so many of our cases are compelling and outrageous that it's not hard to get up in the morning and come in and work on these cases.
Actual Innocence is a podcast that tells the stories of people who served time for crimes they did not commit. Listen to the heartbreaking true accounts of wrongfully convicted people and their journey to exoneration. Thanks so much for listening. The Helpers 1 and 2 received so much positive feedback that I decided to record some more Helpers episodes. This episode specifically focuses on the appeal process and will feature interviews from three current or former appellate attorneys. I'm Brooke, and these are the Helpers. It's so easy for me to promote our sponsor, Bombas Socks, because I love their product. I will never promote a sponsor that I don't believe in, but by having Bombas Socks as a sponsor, I feel like I'm able to help people in the midst of a podcast designed to help people. And now, it's time for me to introduce our Bombas Kid of the Week.
My name is Isabella. I'm 10 years old.
I asked you to test something out. Can you tell me what it is?
I have been testing out socks.
How do these socks feel?
These socks feel really comfortable. It's really soft and cozy, and I feel like I can run in them.
Do you play any sports?
I used to play flag football.
And do you think these socks would be comfortable for that?
Yes.
Do you like the way they look?
I do.
So what do you like about the way they look?
I like the little stripes at the top. I'm wearing the black one, and there's like pink stripes at the top, and I think that's like giving it a little touch, and I like it.
How do you feel about regular socks?
Regular socks kind of itch me, so like when I'm at school, I always have to try to like take my shoe off and itch my foot because of the socks.
And these socks don't do that?
Nope.
What's a really good thing that happens when someone buys a pair of these socks?
When someone buys a pair of these socks, the company gives them to poor people, which I think is really nice.
Would you recommend these socks to other kids?
Yes, I would. They really feel like heaven, and I think you could play like a lot of sports in these. Remember, you can be the next Bombas Kid of the Week. Visit www.actualinpod.com/bombas. Hashtag good socks for good kid.
You can get socks for you and the kids in your life by visiting www.bombas.com. That's BOMBAS.com. Discount code actual. By using our code, you not only support our podcast and get a 20% discount off your first order, but you also donate Bombas socks to people in need. So remember, www.bombas.com. Discount code actual.
Hashtag be better.
And now on to the show. David Moran, Colin Miller, and Rachel Kamens are the guests that will be featured throughout the interview. Every single one of them was so interesting to talk to, and I feel lucky to have been able to conduct these interviews.
I'm David Moran. I'm the director of the Michigan Innocence Clinic at the University of Michigan Law School, where I'm also a clinical professor of law. I've been the director of the Michigan Innocence Clinic since 2009. I co-founded it with Bridget McCormick, who left the clinic in 2012 to join the Michigan Supreme Court. She was elected to the Michigan Supreme Court. My background is that I spent 8 years at the Michigan State Appellate Defender Office doing criminal appeals for indigent people from across the state. And then after that, I joined the faculty at Wayne State Law School, where I spent 8 years as a professor and then later associate dean of the law school. And then I came to Michigan to start the Michigan Innocence Clinic in 2009.
I'm Colin Miller. I'm a professor and associate dean at the University of South Carolina School of Law. Before that, I was an attorney at a litigation firm in D.C. and an appellate court attorney in New York. And I'm one of the hosts of the Undisclosed podcast.
My name's Rachel Kamens, and I'm a criminal defense attorney in Baltimore, Maryland. I have been in private practice doing criminal defense exclusively for 12 years. The focal point of my practice is appellate work and post-conviction work and anything that a defendant might need after he has been convicted and sentenced in an effort to either get a new trial or gain release or gain a lower sentence or gain a belated appeal or pretty much any possibility of getting any sort of relief from the conviction and or sentence that he's serving. The first part of my career, I did exclusively criminal appeals for the Maryland Attorney General's Office. And at least in Maryland, the Attorney General's Office represents the state in every single appeal from every county in the state. So it'll go from the individual state's attorney's offices statewide to the Attorney General's Office when the case goes up on appeal. And for the initial appeal, as well as a couple other appeals after that, the AG's office handles them on behalf of the state. And so that's what I did out of law school for 11 years before I went to the dark side and became an attorney for the defense.
You heard Rachel joke about going over to the dark side when she started as a defense attorney. I wanted to know more about that and the stigma associated with being on the defense side of the courtroom.
It's just part of the nature of criminal defense is that you're going to lose the vast majority of criminal appeals because the appellate courts are going to look for reasons to affirm, uphold a criminal conviction unless you give them solid reasons to believe that an injustice has been done.
I've never heard a reaction to being a prosecutor that was anywhere near the reaction that I got when I switched from being a prosecutor to being a defense attorney, meaning that there does not seem to be any kind of bias or negative impression of prosecuting a criminal, but definitely society seems to look upon being a defense attorney as the dark side. I mean, you know, it's not even original anymore. I've heard it 100 times. And that's from people who are prosecutors, people who are just, you know, regular people who don't have any legal related job. And even defense attorneys themselves seem to, in a joking way, look upon it as the dark side. And I think it's, you know, it's just kind of self-deprecation when they say it. But yeah, I think that there is a societal bias towards helping criminals. And I get on a regular basis questions like, well, how can you represent somebody knowing that they did that really awful thing?
Oh, I mean, there's a huge stigma against defense attorneys, public defenders, et cetera. I was consulting on a case last fall and talking to a public defender, and they were saying how, you know, the clients would say, are you actually an attorney? Are you just a law student? They're not given that much respect. And of course, defense attorneys in general, a lot of people look at them as, well, you're representing the worst of society and monsters, and how can you possibly represent rapists and domestic abusers, et cetera?
How can they possibly represent rapists, domestic abusers, etc.?
I love when I get asked that question because I think there's really significant answers that need to be said and repeated over and over again. And if you are going to have a criminal justice system and a process in place for making sure that the Constitution is upheld and that the rules of your particular jurisdiction are implemented and enforced, then the whole system would be meaningless and would capsize if there aren't people like criminal defense attorneys, just as importantly as prosecutors, who play the various roles to make the system work. And a lot of people are arrested and even convicted on the say-so of somebody else. And so if somebody came and arrested you one day and said that you did something bad, you would surely want there to be a code of rules that was followed. And I think that that's the easy answer to, you know, when my own children ask me, well, but how can you represent that murderer? Well, at the place when I get involved in a case, it's not often guilt or innocence. It's were all the rules followed, just on a very fundamental level. You have to make sure that the rules were followed and that the person's rights were observed and that the system worked correctly, whatever the outcome may be. So I feel like that's totally justifiable reason to represent defendants, you know, guilty or not guilty.
And the way that I have always looked at it from the days I initially got interested in law was, you know, that's the way the American system is set up, that you have vigorous representation of the best of society and the worst of society and everything in between. And that's your obligation as an attorney in an adversarial system, is you have to, within the laws of justice and ethics, provide competent, coherent, and fair representation to anyone who might be facing criminal charges, the loss of custody, deportation, etc.
Over the course of my interview, I noticed a lot of he's and hims being used. So I asked about the ratio of women to men as defendants.
I have, in the entire time that I've represented criminal defendants, only had two female clients out of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of clients altogether. I mean, there are clearly so many fewer women than men inmates.
More than 90% of all prison inmates are male. The proportion of women is growing in the prison population, but the vast majority of criminal defendants are male. The overwhelming majority of people exonerated by DNA are male because the vast majority of DNA exonerations involve rape. Rape is by far the most likely crime in which the perpetrator will leave behind biological evidence, usually semen. Women are very unlikely to be exonerated of rape because they're very unlikely to be convicted of rape in the first place, much less leave behind biological evidence that can be tested, even if they are convicted of rape.
I mentioned Julie Baumer and Lorinda Swain, both exonerees related to the Michigan Innocence Clinic.
We're a non-DNA, primarily non-DNA innocence clinic, which is why it's been possible for us to have a greater proportion of female clients and female exonerees. So 3 of our 13 so far have been women. That would be an extremely high proportion for a DNA innocence project.
I wanted to know why appeals exist in the first place. What's their purpose?
Yeah, so the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution guarantees the right to a trial by jury of your peers. And what the Supreme Court has said is the right to an appeal is part and parcel of that right because the appeal is ensuring that if there were any significant errors that occurred during that trial, that they can be corrected and we can ensure that that person was not convicted based upon bad evidence, bad law, the judge making mistakes, the jury making mistakes.
How does a person get started with an appeal?
I'm going to base my response on the system that is in place in Maryland. There are analogous systems in other states, but you know, there are definitely variations and I can't speak to those. But in Maryland, when a person is convicted, they have the immediate opportunity that presents itself for them to try to undo what has happened is to file a motion for new trial. And that is often heard the same day as the sentence before the sentence is imposed. And at that point, I think they have 10 days after the actual conviction to file their motion for new trial. And because they're so routinely denied, they're usually heard immediately before sentence is imposed. So I don't think that the vast majority of defendants really do even bother filing motions for new trial, except in the most egregious circumstances where they feel that some really serious error took place at the trial and they, you know, feel that it should be addressed even before the case goes to appeal. So that's not an appeal, but it's the first step that's available to a defendant to try to challenge his conviction.
Yeah, there's basically two different types of appeals. One is direct appeal and one is collateral appeal. So a direct appeal is the initial appeal that you would have. And a direct appeal is based upon errors that are evident from the trial record. You can point to the trial record and say, listen, this witness, this police officer was allowed to testify that Ed, this eyewitness, saw the defendant commit the crime. And that's wrong because that's hearsay. You need the eyewitness to come in. So that's the direct appeal.
The appeal that one takes after one is convicted. So in most states, and Michigan's no exception, if you're convicted of a felony, you have a right to file an appeal to the Michigan Court of Appeals, and then you can also continue on to the Michigan Supreme Court and even on to the U.S. Supreme Court by asking those courts to hear your appeals, and that's called the direct appeal.
Every defendant has an initial appeal of right, meaning it's not discretionary whether the court hears the appeal. The court will hear the appeal, and the defendant has 30 days to file a notice of appeal, which is just a piece of paper saying, I hereby file an appeal and I'm going to be pursuing an appeal. And within a course of a few months, the case is processed into the appellate court from the trial court or the circuit court where it was held. And in Maryland, it's called the Court of Special Appeals, even though they hear all the appeals, they still call themselves the Court of Special Appeals. And the Court of Special Appeals, if you cannot afford a private lawyer, the Public Defender's Office Appeal Division represents you. And in that first level appeal, the issues that you can raise are very limited. And they are really limited to trial court error in terms of, you know, more typically rulings that the trial court has made to admit or exclude evidence during the trial, or the judge's rulings on objections made during the course of closing argument, or things involving the voir dire process, jury selection, any number of things that fall within the category of error committed by the trial court, with the additional limitation that you cannot just raise an issue of trial court error if you didn't raise it in the trial court. And that concept is called preserving the record. And what it means is the appellate court has a rule that says you cannot bring something up for the first time in the appeals court. It has to have been raised and decided at the trial court level. So if the judge does something that in the course of the trial that you don't think was correct, it is incumbent upon you as the defense attorney to object to it and make known to the trial court that you're displeased with his action or inaction. And you have to get a ruling from the court, like, I don't care, or, oh, you're right, you know, let me correct myself. Either way, the judge has to acknowledge your objection and make a ruling. And when you have those two factors, you then can raise it in the appeal court. And if you try to raise something in the appeal court that was not preserved in the trial court, then in the vast majority of cases, the appeal court will say, we're not addressing this because you've waived your right to bring that to our attention. So when you go through, as an appellate lawyer, you go through a transcript, you really have to hone in on the issues that were raised in and decided by the trial court in order to frame what issues you're going to raise on that first level appeal. So that's the first level appeal. Every defendant has the right to one, and Court of Special Appeals will issue a decision affirming or reversing the judgment in the lower court.
And what are the outcomes that could occur from an appeal?
At that first level appeal, which is straight from your conviction, every defendant has the right to go to the Court of Special Appeals, and the appeal will be heard or entertained by the Court of Special Appeals. Sometimes there's oral argument on the appeal, and even when there's not, there's full briefing done by the parties, and the court is required to issue an opinion, and that opinion will be either affirming what happened in the trial court or reversing it. So you're automatically in the Court of Special Appeals when you note that appeal, and then the outcome of the appeal is going to either be to vacate the conviction altogether or change in some way the sentence. Like in certain instances, the whole entire trial isn't going to be vacated, but some component of the sentence was illegal for some reason, or one of several convictions may be overturned on appeal and will affect, therefore, only one of the sentences, but the others remain intact. Typically, though, the relief, if you win your appeal, is you get a do-over, essentially, which is usually what it is. It's a new trial. If the Court of Special Appeals rules that the errors that you alleged were such as to warrant reversal of the convictions, then you get a new trial. It's usually remanded back to the trial court to start all over again. I mean, theoretically, the state could drop the charges at that point, but, you know, more typically, the state will proceed anew and re-prosecute the defendant, or at least recharge the defendant. And then, you know, it could either go through a whole trial the second go round, or the defendant could engage in plea discussions, you know, just like he could have from the outset the first time.
So I think I get it. I get a direct appeal automatically, and with it, an attorney. The possibilities are my appeal will result in a new trial, or more commonly, it won't. What does a person do if they lose their first direct appeal?
That appeal is denied, and that's typically your best opportunity to get relief from any court. At that point, your options get a little more restricted and less likely to succeed. And the immediate thing that's available to a defendant who loses his appeal in the Court of Special Appeals is to attempt to get Maryland's highest court to review the case. And you have to file what's called a petition for writ of certiorari. We call them cert petitions because no one can pronounce certiorari. You have about 45 days from the date of the Court of Special Appeals opinion to file your cert petition. And in your cert petition, you are trying to convince Maryland's highest court, which is called the Court of Appeals, to exercise its very limited resources to review your case. And so it's not an appeal of right. It's a discretionary appeal. It is said that the Court of Appeals grants somewhere around 2% of all of the cert petitions that it gets presented with. And therefore, in order to stand any chance of your case being one of those, you have to not only allege that the Court of Special Appeals was wrong in denying your appeal, but you have to convince the Court of Appeals that there's something really unique and special and interesting about your case that makes it worthwhile for the Court of Appeals to take. And typically that involves trying to convince that court that your case has an issue or issues that are likely to present themselves in a whole bunch of other cases as well. And it's really a great idea for them to take this case and make new law, essentially, or make law on the issue to serve as guidance for, you know, lower courts throughout the state, because every opinion that's issued by the Court of Appeals is a published opinion that serves as legal precedent for the courts below. Whereas in the Court of Special Appeals, they can publish and do publish many of their decisions, and they can serve as precedent, but they also cannot publish it. So if they don't publish it, it just is authority for that particular defendant's case. If they do publish it, then it too can serve as precedent for trial courts to follow. And also for other cases that go up to the Court of Special Appeals, they have precedent from their own court to apply in resolving other appeals. So basically all that is to say that if you want to get your case on direct appeal, as we call it, heard by the Court of Appeals, it's a very, very high burden. And it's a very low chance of success that you're actually going to get heard by that court.
In the interviews I've conducted, exonerees often talk about losing multiple appeals. I wondered how many chances at an appeal that a person might get.
Yeah, there is a limit in the sense that you have usually one bite of the apple on direct appeal and one bite of the apple on collateral or post-conviction appeal. And if it's something you could have raised in either of those, that's typically waived. So if I, in my direct appeal, don't challenge a hearsay ruling by the trial judge, I can't raise that again. And if I fail to claim ineffective assistance of counsel in my collateral appeal, I typically can't raise that again. But then there's other things, like I mentioned before, DNA. If there's DNA that's out there, that could be tested after the fact in many states and lead to a new appeal. Or there could be what's called new evidence. And that's evidence that couldn't have been discovered through due diligence before the appeals.
I needed to stop Colin for a second and ask him if he could explain the legal definition of due diligence.
That is a very fact-intensive inquiry that the court undertakes. There's not sort of a bright line rule or tests. The question is basically, if you're looking at it from the perspective of an attorney on appeal, is this something that a reasonable attorney would have uncovered him or herself? And so, for instance, deep in the files of the police department is this confession. That's something that the attorney would not have uncovered. On the other hand, let's say that a defendant is claiming 16 years after their conviction that there's this alibi witness who never testified. Well, the question would be, why didn't the defendant raise this alibi witness earlier? That's certainly something that through due diligence could have been investigated and presented at the time of the appeal.
As he was saying,
that would allow for the post-conviction proceeding to be reopened and allow for a new appeal to be heard. So, for instance, in Adnan's case, that was the fact that the prosecutor, at least allegedly, had dissuaded the alibi witness from appearing at his first hearing. It could be a Brady violation. It could be something where a police officer, after the post-conviction proceeding, comes forward and says, you know, actually, we've been hiding all these years, but in fact, Al, this alternate suspect, confessed to the crime, and that, you know, also would be new evidence that would allow for the post-conviction to be reopened.
You have that first appeal to, you know, what is the intermediate appellate court, And then you have your next appeal to that, the highest court. We call it Court of Appeals. Lots of other states call it the Supreme Court of the state, but it's the same thing. The appeals that you're talking about would, I imagine, be literally post-convictions, which is, it is appropriate to call them appeals, although I wouldn't, only because that mixes the terminology up a little bit, whereas appeals specifically refer to direct appeal, meaning you go from the trial court to the intermediate appellate court to the highest court of that state. And then if you want to try, you can take your case up to the Supreme Court of the United States. And that's considered all part of the direct appeal process. The people who have tons of appeals are probably referring to other types of challenges that can be raised in their state. And in Maryland, and I think in most states, it's referred to as post-conviction.
Well, there's only one direct appeal. Then after that, so in Michigan, it's typical, you have what's called a motion for relief from judgment. Other places call it state habeas. What this proceeding is you going back to court trying to overturn your conviction, and you are limited to grounds that you did not raise on a direct appeal, and you have to have good reasons why you couldn't have raised them on your direct appeal. So you can't save some of your best reasons for overturning your conviction for later. You're supposed to raise any issues that you know about on direct appeal. So that severely limits what you can do on post-conviction. And in many states, you can only file one post-conviction motion, and you can file one federal habeas petition. In Michigan, there's an exception to both of those things. There's also an exception in federal court that you can file further post-conviction motions if you find new evidence after you filed the first one. So if you filed one post-conviction motion, say, 2 years after you were convicted, and then 10 years later you discover new evidence, then you can file a second one.
I asked for more information about post-convictions.
When somebody who doesn't know anything about the law asks what a post-conviction is, I usually say, if I think that this answer is going to satisfy them, I usually say it's basically a kind of appeal. It is. It's not wrong to say that. But as a term of art, an appeal takes place in an appeals court, whereas post-conviction is a challenge to your conviction and your sentence, just like an appeal is, but it does not go to and is not heard by an appeals court. It is heard by a judge in the same court, the circuit court or the trial court, that the conviction took place in. And you're getting review on a different type of error. And this is where ineffective assistance of counsel comes in. You are having a review of those types of errors and other types of constitutional errors by a judge in that same court.
A collateral appeal is based upon errors that are not evident from the trial record, namely ineffective assistance of counsel, and that is also called post-conviction review. So after that direct appeal, based upon things an appellate court could say, oh, I can look at the trial record and say that's an error, the defendant can then bring a collateral appeal, also known as post-conviction, where they're saying, well, here's some other stuff that aren't evident from the trial record, but if you dig deeper and look outside that record, I can point to these various errors that caused my conviction.
So post-conviction work are where you're going back to the trial court and saying, look, I've got new evidence that should overturn my conviction, or you're going to federal court saying my constitutional rights were violated.
Every defendant has a post-conviction, their first post-conviction, they automatically get it. It's not discretionary, let's put it that way. They have a right to have their post-conviction heard or entertained by a judge one time. And I won't bore you with how the law has evolved on that. It used to be that they had more than one, and then I guess things got kind of kooky, so they limited it to one petition as of right for every criminal defendant. So after the appeals process is done, you don't have to go through the appeals process to do the post-conviction, but why wouldn't you? Everybody does. You get your post-conviction. You have, in Maryland, the right to counsel at that first post-conviction, just like you did at your first appeal. And you are guaranteed to have a hearing on your post-conviction petition for that one time. And after you've done your post-conviction, you, where the multiple quote-unquote appeals might be coming in, are where you have the right to file as many motions to reopen your post-conviction as you want. There's no time limit, and there's no limit on how many or how often you file a motion to reopen your post-conviction. But past that initial post-conviction, you're not entitled to have a hearing. The court isn't required to do anything. They don't have to issue an opinion. They don't really even have to give you the courtesy of a denial. They can ignore it. In Adnan Syed's case, I will say that what happened in his case was actually a motion to reopen his post-conviction, which he did have a hearing on, which is difficult to achieve. And it's, again, it's discretionary. Past that initial post-conviction that he had many years ago, they had to present the court with really compelling reasons to reopen the post-conviction. And they did that successfully. And the post-conviction was reopened. And they basically had what was tantamount to another post-conviction hearing. And that was just the procedural posture of his case, just to distinguish it from that initial post-conviction where you were guaranteed to get into court and have your issues resolved.
Many of the exonerees that I spoke with talked about spending time in the law library. I wondered at what point a person loses their right to an attorney.
And that varies from state to state. So for many states, you only have the right to an attorney on direct appeal. You don't have the right to an attorney for collateral or post-conviction appeal. For many defendants, if they have been convicted, their direct appeal has been denied, and they're now trying to claim ineffective assistance of counsel or something collateral to the actual trial record, they do not have the right to an appointed attorney.
Our job is to provide counsel for people who wouldn't otherwise have attorneys. And you have a constitutional right to have an attorney help you with at least the first stages of the direct appeal, at least the appeal to the Michigan Court of Appeals. So we're not interested in taking on cases and replacing another attorney. After those direct appeals are over, however, you don't have any right to have an attorney. And that's the point at which you really need an attorney to help you with post-conviction. You don't have a right to have a counsel for that. And so those are the cases with very rare exceptions that we're going to take.
The next sponsor is easy for me to support because not only is he a local business owner, but he's the father of the little girls that I watch on the weekends. He's here to tell us about his company, which has small town values and an office the size of the globe.
My name is TJ. I am the founder of TJ21 Media Group. We're based in South Bend, Indiana, near Notre Dame, but we travel all over the country.
What exactly do you do?
We tell everyone that we're a media marketing company, not just necessarily a marketing firm, but not necessarily just a video production house, because we kind of do everything. We do a lot of weddings. We do a lot of projects. We shoot a lot of commercials. We were just in Los Angeles for a few days shooting a fitness expo. So we kind of have a wide range of things we do. Video is a huge part of that. We shoot a lot of videos. We've shot stuff internationally. We've been to Vietnam, India, Japan, of course, all over the country. Destination weddings. That's probably what we're most known for is our weddings. But our commercials and our documentaries are pretty powerful.
Even though you live down the street from me, you were in Los Angeles last weekend shooting.
My week last week started out with South Bend, Chicago, Orlando, back to Chicago, back to Los Angeles, back here to South Bend. And while we were in Los Angeles, I got a call from University of Notre Dame asking us to film a project for the next 4 days. So we're like scrambling around because you don't turn Notre Dame down. So we're adjusting our schedule to try to figure out a way that we can make it work. And we did. We had a staff at Notre Dame shooting. So yeah, we are actually all over the world.
If I understood right, you do things for businesses like commercials or documentaries, but you also do things for just individuals.
Absolutely. We've actually had people that contact us and say, I have an aspiring young actor. I have a 10-year-old daughter that wants to get a video made. And what can I do? They'll come in. They'll get on our green screen here. Or if they're across the country, we've actually had somebody, we had to go down to Alabama for one day. We were actually gone for 24 hours. We flew down there, filmed their daughter doing some kind of a dance and a singing routine and flew right back. But yeah, we do it for consumers, everyday people, and then businesses. We filmed a documentary out of Fort Lauderdale earlier this spring about child sex trafficking. And that one's a really hard one. As a father myself, that was very difficult to do. But we knew what we were doing was we're fighting against such a horrible situation. So were we not only just filming a project for a customer, we were in a sense becoming an advocate as well. For more information about TJ21 Media Group, you can visit tj21.com.
This Helpers episode was so full of information, I decided to break it down into two parts so that your brain and mine would have some time to process the information provided. On the next Helpers episode, we will talk about legal terms and also more about what happens on the federal level and how the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act has affected the appeals process. I'm going to leave you with this story from Colin. I'm Brooke. Thanks for listening.
One of the first cases that I worked on was an arson case, an arson appeal. And the first thing that I saw when looking at the case were these photographs of the bodies and just the state that they were in. And, you know, it's odd in a sense, but I guess it's the same with all attorneys. You almost become desensitized a bit the more and more you work on it. But that always drove it home for me, that the very first appeal that I worked on, where, you know, you go in and you're trying to do justice and you're trying to keep in mind the defendant's rights and trying to prove those wrongful convictions. But that was very sobering in the sense that you look at it and you say, well, I mean, obviously there's a victim here and there's a very real concern. While there are many wrongful convictions, there are many people who are rightfully convicted, and you want to make sure that you're working for justice. And it's a tough thing to do for all involved. I mean, I certainly have never worked as a prosecutor, but I respect the obligation that they have to try to bring justice to crime victims in society. So I think that was a good first case to have, because it really set me up in looking at the entire holistic situation, as opposed to, you know, you're always as an attorney, an advocate, and you're looking at it from one perspective. But seeing that broader picture, I think, was important.
The Actual Innocence Podcast website is www.actualinpod.com. That's actualinpod.com. Share your feedback and questions by emailing actualinnocencepod@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter @actualinpod. Please show your support by rating us and giving us a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast app, or by becoming one of our Patreon sponsors by clicking the support link on our website. Remember, sharing this podcast and the stories of those who have been exonerated help to fix our criminal justice system. I'm Brooke. Thanks for listening.